Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. This is the Thursday edition, and this is your host, Randy L. Noble. So glad that you've taken some time out of your busy schedule to join me on the program today. Well, I have to begin the program today on a very, very sad note. Several hours ago in Tehran, there was a horrific, horrific fire. And it was at a building called the Plasco Building. It was a very high skyscraper. And there was a massive, horrific fire, and more than 30 firefighters have been feared dead in the blaze. It was a major commercial building in Tehran, and it collapsed after firefighters were battling the blaze. The images of this fire remind me of 9/11, of the collapse of the World Trade Centers. When you watch this video of these firefighters battling the blaze, and then subsequent to that, you see the building collapse. It's a horrific scene that reminds me of the terrorist attacks on 9/11, the building that is collapsing. And apparently there were some issues in this building with many, many violations. And they had been warned about some very unsafe things that were happening in the building, and it's just horrific. They did not heed the warnings, and as a result of that, there were fires. Stairwells had a lot of clothing stored in them. It was against the fire safety standards, and the managers didn't pay attention to the warnings, and this major commercial building after firefighters were battling it for many, many hours, it collapsed, and more than 30 firefighters are feared dead. And so my thoughts and prayers this morning are with the brave, brave firefighters in Tehran who have given their life to save many other lives in battling a blaze. And so let's remember them today in our thoughts and prayers. These are brave, unselfish, hardworking firefighters who gave their lives in the cause of saving many, many innocent people and perished in this blaze. Well, this morning on the Cross in the Desert, I want to talk about an issue that is very near and dear to my heart, and that's the rights of women in Iran. And we're going to talk about that issue. But before we do, I want to do something a little bit different on the Cross of the Desert. I want to play some bicycling and car traveling music. This is the music of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Running Down a Dream, right now on the Cross of the Desert. We'll get it to start.
Iranian women are posting photos and videos of themselves riding bicycles under the hashtag Iranian Women Love Cycling. It's a social media movement that started after Iran's supreme leader issued a fatwa banning women from riding bikes. There's actually no law in place yet, but in July, a group of women were arrested for cycling. That arrest has since kicked off a movement for women's freedom in protest of the fatwa.
Okay, now I think you understand why I was playing Tom Petty, Running Down a Dream. That's what these Iranian women are doing. They're cycling in spite of this fatwa, in defiance of this law. Now, this was something that took place back in September when you saw all of these pictures and videos on social media. But I wanted to revisit this issue because these women are just at the top of my list of courageous women who are battling this kind of ridiculous, un-American, I could call it that way, of course that's what it is, this inhumane edict, this inhumane rule that says that women cannot ride bicycles in Iran socially and out in public. According to the BBC, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei earlier the month of September issued a decree stating that women are prohibited from cycling in public or in the presence of strangers. Riding a bicycle often attracts the attention of men and exposes the society to corruption and thus contravenes women's chastity, and it must be abandoned. That is what Khamenei said in relationship to this law, that it is corrupting women. Are you hearing me so far this morning? It's the most ridiculous statement. Well, these women won't take this sitting down, if you will. In response, women have begun using social media as a form of protest, risking prosecution and possible jail time if caught defying the edict. One Facebook group dubbed My Stealthy Freedom has garnered over 1 million likes and has received thousands of images uploaded along with a dozen videos showing women throughout the Islamic Republic openly contravening social taboos such as the bicycle ban. Hello, we just finished biking in the city now, one video says. We are 9 people. 2 more joined us in our path, one woman said in a video posted to the Facebook group of herself riding a bike. Quote, I am proud that I did resist the oppression, as I believe those who oppress us are wrong, she added. Biking for women is not taboo, and no one can tell me it is. And so this one brave woman on a video is stating her case. In another post, a mother and daughter duet issued a direct message to the Ayatollah saying, quote, we love cycling and we are not going to give it up. So you see these brave women in videos and in still photography. They're standing up against this ridiculous ban. They are saying to the Ayatollah, we are not going to accept this. Now, I want to spend just a couple of minutes on this issue. About 4 years ago or more, after I just began being a voice for Iranians, I wrote a blog about this issue, and it's called No Female Bikers Allowed. So I want to read this to you and talk about this issue. Just recently, my special friend Sahar celebrated her 26th birthday. She is a mother, a wife, and an architect living in Tehran, Iran. During our online chat, Sahar shared with me an event on her birthday that brought her great joy and happiness. She rode her friend's bicycle for 10 minutes and said this was the best birthday gift that anyone ever had given her. Sahar then went on to explain that in Iran, women are not allowed to ride bicycles publicly. In 1999, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Al-Khamenei declared, quote, women must avoid anything that attracts strangers. So riding bicycles by women in public places causes corruption and is thus forbidden. It is not surprising that this is one more rule to keep women in their, quote, proper place. It is one more rule that suppresses true freedom and enjoyment. Unfortunately, at one time in America, women were held hostage by oppressive sexist rules and were denied the right to vote. In the early 19th century, the bicycle, when rode by a woman, was also viewed as a threat to the social order and a provocation to promiscuity. The famous women's activist Susan B. Anthony pointed out that, quote, the bicycle has done more for the emancipation of women than anything else in the world, end quote. We've come a long way since the 19th century in recognizing the rights of women and giving them the dignity and respect that they deserve in both the marketplace and in the home. But what can we do for the millions of women who are suffering from government oppression in Iran? What about them? In the last decade, thanks to the hardworking efforts of former First Lady Laura Bush, for the first time in Islamic history, the women of Afghanistan were given the right to vote in elections. It's time that the women in Iran are set free from the oppressive shackles and chains of a male-dominated society. But before I leave on this blog, I have just one question for the government of Iran. Why is it okay for you to develop nuclear weapons of mass destruction and ultimately will wipe out entire nations, but it's not okay for women to ride bicycles in public? What is wrong with this picture? I pray one day that my friend Sahar will be able to migrate here to America where I live to enjoy our freedoms. And if by God's grace we should meet, I'm going to give Sahar a special gift, her very own bicycle. She will be allowed to ride it more than a few minutes. Sahar will have the great joy of riding it up and down every public street without fear. I hope and pray that I live to see that. Yes, that was several years ago, but listen to this issue. It is still alive. It is still a burning issue among women who also fight the government oppression of not wanting to have to wear the hijab. They want to have a choice to go out publicly without the hijab, and yet they too can be arrested and fined and even publicly lashed for not wearing a proper hijab. So for the women of Iran, life there is oppressive. It is a male-dominated society, and they need our thoughts and prayers and our voice to speak up for their freedom. It's so very, very sad. It's the reason why I do this radio program. It's the reason why I write books to defend the right of women. I wanted to mention in passing, I'm going to be soon finishing the book I'm writing, and then I will begin a new project. It's a book written about my dear friend Maral and her escape from Iran over a year and a half ago, where she joined a group of refugees. And she literally joined them in climbing over the mountains in Turkey, was part of a group on a rubber raft in the Aegean Sea, making her way to Greece. She went through jungles. She went without food and water. She was very sick, and by God's grace, made it to Germany right at the end of last year. And she has shared with me on Skype this incredible journey of leaving Iran, and it is turned into a book. On the front cover of our book is a picture of Maral standing next to her bicycle. And this is beautiful because here in Germany, she will have the freedom to ride her bicycle without some edict. And she will have the freedom in Germany to go public without her hijab. And so I thought this was a perfect book cover because I'm celebrating Maral's freedom in Germany as an Iranian citizen now, who can look back and say, I have true freedom. The sad thing is that she had to go all the way to Germany to find that freedom, when in Iran, she should have that freedom as a woman. I want to turn now to an issue that will affect very strongly the core of Iran's political future, and that is the recent death of former President Rafsanjani. And what will this mean with Iran's political future? I want you to hear this special report right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Rafael Lenny joins us now to talk more about the impact the former president's death is expected to have on Iran. Sreya, you spent some time in Iran. You've studied Iranian politics to some length. I think it's quite interesting listening to how divisive the country is over Rafsanjani's death. He represented, of course, the moderate and reformist voices, but he also had many criticisms in his legacy, the Iran-Iraq War, the 1988 massacre. Tell us more about his legacy.
Well, that's right. It is quite divisive because he was a very pragmatic man who changed his positions and changed factions over the course of his career, but it really can be summed up by saying Hashemi Rafsanjani is basically the Islamic Republic. No one could ever imagine the Islamic Republic without him. He was one of the founding members who created this system. He was very close to the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, his right-hand man in many ways. So he was really integral in choosing the successor to Khomeini when he died, which is the current supreme leader. So this was a very integral, decisive moment in history, which Rafsanjani was very much part of. He set the direction of the Republic when Khomeini died. Even though he himself was not supreme leader, that really speaks to his power. He was the head of the modern right faction, of course, before he became a moderate later in life. He was de facto commander of the Iranian armed forces during the Iran-Iraq war, the longest conventional war in modern history. And he was also he also played a very decisive role in convincing the Iranian leadership to accept a ceasefire and put an end to the most traumatic period of Iranian modern history, 8 years of war. After that, he became known as the commander of constructiveness because of his push to rebuild the country and also a push of economic liberalization. Also, throughout his career, he really did lead this charge of normalization of relations with the United States. A lot of people don't realize, but this has been something that's been happening for 35 years. And Rafsanjani was very much a very, very vocal, proponent of this push.
So he was sort of a balancing component, but at the same time really upholding the high interests of the regime. So what happens now? I mean, what does this mean for the future of Iranian politics, especially given the fact that elections are only coming up in about 6 months' time?
Well, his legacy in many ways rests on the current president, Hassan Rouhani, because Rouhani is his protege. And basically, of all of the followers of Rafsanjani, he is the most successful and there is the most hope resting on his shoulders. So there is a lot of argument now as to whether or not Rafsanjani was a liability for reformists or whether he actually played a constructive role. So Rouhani is up for election. He's running for a second term. So there are thoughts that maybe this will damage his chances. But there are also other thoughts that say, well, it really won't have that much impact at all, because Rouhani now can move out of Rafsanjani's shadow and build his own legacy.
And that they're already sort of on the one trajectory. All right, Soraya, very interesting. Thank you very much for your contributions there. Soraya Lenny for us.
A couple of significant notes on Rafsanjani. He was 82. He died of a heart attack after being transferred to a hospital. Rouhani, I think, was at his bedside shortly before he died. And as mentioned, he actually was responsible in killing hundreds of thousands of Iranian citizens and dispatching children and young students to the minefields during the war with Iraq in the 1980s. What is most significant about Rafsanjani, he had a key role in all the assassinations abroad before and after Khomeini's death. And this assassinations abroad were condemned by German courts, and he was wanted by international police and the Argentina judiciary for the Buenos Aires bombing, which resulted in the death of 86 people. This was back, I believe, in 1994, a bombing. And so this man was a criminal in many, many ways. I've heard reports he became a reformer, that he was battling for power with Khomeini, that he was at odds with Ahmadinejad. But this man has a criminal record. He was responsible for many of the deaths in the 1988 political massacre in Iran, where thousands, almost 30,000 political prisoners, a lot of them members of the Mojahedin, the MEK, he had them killed. And so this man has a criminal background. He's responsible for the Islamic Revolution in many ways, the creation of the Supreme Leader office. And the whole political structure has risen and fallen on people like Rafsanjani. So time will tell just exactly what the impact of his death will be, especially now with the upcoming elections in Iran. This August, I believe, and voting would begin in June. Of course, once again, when I say voting, be very careful. Iranians have to go to the polls or they lose their benefits. They keep record of whether they vote or not, and so it's almost mandatory. In fact, it is. And Iranians are coerced to vote for really the picks of the supreme leader. He has the final say on who can run in this election. And so it's really not a democratic election, although Iran wants to give the appearance that it is. Now, speaking of Iran, with the Trump administration taking office officially tomorrow, on January 20th, it is a huge day of celebration for conservatives like myself. We have a transition from the oppression of Obama apolitics to the freedom of Donald Trump and the prosperity and the hope he's going to bring our country tomorrow on January 20th. But the Trump administration has received a letter from many of those in Congress about coming up with a different policy to deal with the Iran issue, especially the nuclear agreement that was signed a year or so ago with the Obama administration. There needs to be a new tough policy against the Iranians, especially the government of Iran. And just recently, John Bolton was on Fox News to talk about what this proposal to the Trump administration about a new policy on Iran is all about. We're going to listen to this here on The Cross in the Desert.
Well, now to a Fox News exclusive. As Iran's deputy foreign minister this morning says this country will not renegotiate the nuclear deal reached with the six world powers, including the United States. Sources say President-elect Trump has received this hand-delivered letter. It's signed by 23 former top U.S. officials urging a new approach to Tehran. It calls on the incoming Trump administration to engage and work with the Iranian opposition, something previous administrations apparently haven't done. It is signed by a range of bipartisan officials such as Rudy Giuliani, former Senator Joe Lieberman, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President Clinton, General Hugh Shelton, among others. It says, quote, President Obama expressed the hope that nuclear negotiations would induce Iran's leader to act with greater consideration of American interests. It is now clear that Iran's leaders have shown no interest in reciprocating. Iran's rulers have directly targeted U.S. strategic interests, policies, and principles, and those of our allies and friends in the Middle East. To restore American influence and credibility in the world, the United States needs a revised policy. John Bolton, former ambassador to the United Nations, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Fox News contributor, joins us now. He has supported the Iranian opposition. Ambassador, with this letter, what type of revised policy are they calling for, and what type of new policy do you think we need?
Well, I think the basic problem here, of course, is the regime of the Ayatollahs in charge in Tehran. It's been the problem since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. People talk about Islamic terrorism. They refer to ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Let's make it clear what the real source of support for terrorism around the world. It's the regime in Tehran. They're the world's central banker. They fund Hezbollah. They fund Hamas. They fund plenty of others, and they're well on the road to developing nuclear weapons. And I think what the signatories of this letter are trying to say, and just to underline how bipartisan the group is, you don't see a lot of that in Washington. We haven't for the past 8 or 10 years. So this is, I think, a very significant gathering of people to say the real problem here is the regime in Tehran. It's unpopular. It sits in power because of its control over the Revolutionary Guards Corps, the Basiji militia, and others. We saw what happens when people try to express their opposition in the summer of 2009, the fraudulent election there stolen for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The people went into the streets. The Basiji and the Revolutionary Guards Corps crushed them. The Obama administration did nothing. So I think what's being offered here is to say, look, there is an opposition in Iran. It's a lot of different pieces, like all opposition movements. A lot of the groups don't get on well together, but let's be clear. There is an alternative to the Ayatollahs, and if you want to make them more amenable to serious negotiation where they might actually do something, just remind them that their time in power is not eternal.
You know, Mr. Trump has shown himself, if nothing else, to be unorthodox when it comes to foreign policy. I'm thinking of the phone call with the president of Tehran. What would the message be and reaction in Tehran be if Mr. Trump did reach out or the opposition reached out and they had a phone call or they met?
Well, I think just as you mentioned the call of the president of Taiwan, it would have a remarkable effect. Look, I think the United States ought to feel free to speak to whomever it wants to speak to if it's in the best interest of the United States. That doesn't mean you speak to everybody, but it does mean you pick your shots. And just because the government in Beijing doesn't like it when we talk to the Taiwanese, just as I'm sure the Ayatollahs will not be happy at all for President Trump or members of his administration to talk to the Iranian opposition, the National Council for Resistance. That should not deter us. If anything, that should make us more interested in finding out what we can do to help the legitimate opposition in Iran, from whatever perspective they come from. After the Ayatollahs disappear into the ash heap of history, we can have elections in Iran. We're a long way away from that. There's no guarantee the Trump administration will take this up. But I just I think it's very important, again, to underline what a bipartisan group of people we have here. It's so unusual in Washington. I hope it gets the attention that it deserves.
Yeah, and finally, who would that opposition be? I mean, many of the signatories are supporters, and the letter itself calls for reaching out to the National Resistance, National Council of Resistance of Iran. It's a group that many of the signatories support. You've spoken at their Paris rally for several years. Do you think, and what would the reaction be, that that would be a group to reach out to Mr. Trump, that he potentially could have a meeting, and that is the opening, or could be the opening of the door to the Iranian resistance?
Yeah, I think this is a group that deserves very serious attention. They've got a platform for what their government in a post-Ayatollah Iran would look like, and it pledges, most importantly to me, a non-nuclear weapons Iran. It's open on the question of women's rights in a way, for example, the Ayatollahs would never even consider. It's led by a woman. So it has a lot of, I think, attractions for Americans who are looking for an alternative. There are other alternatives, too. But I think the real point is to say we do not have to accept the Ayatollahs as the legitimate voice of everyone in Iran, because they are not. They are the true illegitimate regime.
The NCRI has been controversial, but certainly this seems to open the door to engaging the opposition and the resistance at some point. We'll see what comes of it. Ambassador John Bolton, as always, thank you for your insight.
Just a couple of notes on the National Council of Resistance of Iran. Yes, there is a divide among Iranians. The accusation was that during the Iran-Iraq war, Mariam Rejavi and her group was supporting Saddam Hussein. In many ways, other Iranians will say that Mariam Rejavi somehow was supporting the Ayatollah, somehow supporting the Iranian regime. There is this huge, very emotional, very violent divide among Iranians on the position of the NCRI. But here's what I want to say about this. During the Obama administration, when there was violent protests during the presidential elections of 2009, and when Ahmadinejad was reelected in what many refer to as a scam, a rigged election, Barack Obama did not reach out to the Iranian resistance, to those protesters, thousands that gave their freedom and many of them their lives in fighting this regime and their oppression. And one of the quotes from that time period was, "President Obama, are you with us or with the mullahs? President Obama, are you with the people of Iran or with the mullahs?" And his voice was silent. And he did not support those protesters who were fighting for their freedom. And so what can happen here with the president is that President Donald Trump can reach out in a way that Obama didn't do. He can reach out to the people of Iran through resistance groups to do everything he can to stand up for the human rights of Iranians that are suffering every single day. Now, he can do that. He can support them in many, many ways by supporting those resistance groups. I think this is an excellent idea, because all we saw in July of 2015 with the signing of this nuclear agreement that never once ever addressed the human rights violations in Iran through execution, through the oppression and death of women. So here Trump has a unique opportunity to stand up for those freedom fighters fighting the Iranian regime. And let's hope and pray that that is something that happens. I want to see it happen. These people have suffered so much. And when this nuclear agreement was signed, all of this money and sanction relief didn't go to help the people that are suffering in the streets. It went to terrorism. It went to Hezbollah and other groups that the Iranian regime supports. And so I want to say that this is an opportunity for tomorrow. President Trump, not president-elect, but tomorrow President Trump, in his time of dealing with so many issues, I hope that he addresses this one issue, that he is very tough on the Iranian government and that he will work with opposition groups to help my dear Iranian friends. Well, what I want to do right now, I want to shift gears once again, and I want to deal with an issue. This is an interview with Bridget Gabriel about the issue of Israel and the United Nations. When the United Nations ratified this vote opposing Israeli settlements in the West Bank area, and when Barack Obama and the United States behind him abstained from this vote, they stabbed Israel in the back. And this was something that he did on his way out of office, and it must be addressed. And we need to understand why this was done to Israel. Well, right now what I want to do, I want to play this interview with the Jan Markel Ministries, Olive Tree Ministries. Bridget Gabriel was recently a guest, and we are going to talk about this issue of Israel and the United Nations and what's really going on behind the scenes. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
Well, stabbing Israel in the back, but actually it was, I think, initiated, as Israel is suggesting, initiated by Barack Obama. Brigitte, which is just staggering, and yet why should we be surprised when a man has spent 20 years under the teaching of Jeremiah Wright, this is what you get, and then his Islamic background as well. I want to play, Brigitte, just a short clip of John Bolton talking about this UN activity back on December 23rd, and then I want to get your response, please.
President Obama stabbing Israel in the back on his way out of office. I'm Eric Bowling in for Sean tonight. Former U.S. Ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, is fired up and will be here in just a moment with reaction. But first, in what many are calling the ultimate betrayal in America's alliance with Israel, the Obama administration earlier today allowed the United Nations to pass a resolution condemning Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank as, quote, a flagrant violation of international law. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is reacting by saying, quote, Israel rejects the shameful anti-Israel resolution at the UN and will not abide by its terms. Netanyahu adding, quote, the Obama administration not only failed to protect Israel against this gang up at the UN, it colluded with it behind the scenes. And President-elect Donald Trump is responding by tweeting this, quote, as to the UN, things will be different after January 20th. Here now with reaction is former U.S. Ambassador to the UN and Fox News contributor John Bolton. Thank you, Ambassador Bolton. Wow, big day at the UN. So tell us, do you think that the UN Security Council colluded with the Obama administration to bring this vote today?
Well, I think certainly the sponsors of the resolution, the Egyptians, some of the others, some of the five permanent members of the council, including Great Britain, obviously had to consult with the Obama administration to tell them what was in the resolution so that it was sufficient for Obama to order an abstention. The United States could have killed this resolution by voting no. It did vote no on a very similar resolution in 2011. But this was, and you said it exactly right at the top of the show, this was a stab in the back against the Israelis. It was entirely predictable. I would say this for people in the pro-Israel community in the United States who defended Obama's Middle East policy over these last 8 years, that you should have seen this coming, and this is what you get for supporting Barack Obama.
Yeah, and this is a shot, I guess, it's at Israel, but also President Obama had a pretty contentious relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, I think it goes beyond the personal. I really think this was an effort to box the incoming Trump administration in, and it violates nearly 50 years of American bipartisan policy on the Middle East, going back to the iconic Resolution 242 after the 1967 war, which established the principle of land for peace. This resolution says basically Israel's occupation is illegitimate, therefore it has no land to give back in exchange for peace. Contrary to what the Obama administration has said, this puts a huge thumb on the scale against Israel. It does go to final status. It does affect Israel's security. It undermines it in profound ways. The consequences of this resolution are going to be felt for many, many years, all negative on Israel and substantially negative on the United States itself.
Brigitte Gabriel, basically we go back to 1967, Auschwitz borders, indefensible. Jerusalem itself becomes occupied territory. Give me your response to this.
Well, we were not surprised. We finally, Obama Obama is showing his true colors, and this is important for the Jewish community who voted for him. Mm-hmm. 80% out of the Jewish community twice, not just once. And now those of us who have warned the leftist Jews in this country about where Obama stands on Israel, I think after this, there is no doubt. And he wanted to do this on his way out, Jan.
Yep.
And here's why. Because remember, who are his advisors on Middle East policy? ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, which is an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation trial as a front for the Muslim Brotherhood. Do you see how the connections right now, the links go back to the Muslim Brotherhood and how they had infiltrated us to the highest
That's
level?
Right.
So President Obama was very close to ISNA, Islamic Society of North America. As a matter of fact, the president of ISNA wrote President Obama's speech, the first famous Arabic speech which he delivered to the Islamic world in Egypt. So this is how we say, you know, we not only have the fox watching the hen house, we have the fox inside the White House
right.
talking policy in the ear of the president. CARE had over 300 visits to the White House under Obama. I mean, the list goes on and on. So Obama is very much influenced by Israel haters who have been actively working for the last 8 years to do everything they can to damage Israel or to do anything where to separate our government from Israel, to sever relationship with Israel as much as they can, or to at least sabotage our relationship with Israel. And they have succeeded. And Obama wanted to make sure he nails the nail in the coffin on his way out the door with this security resolution, with this resolution that the Security Council just passed.
Well, they're saying more is to come. Do you think that's possible?
Well, we will see. I mean, obviously, you are seeing a huge backlash, and I'm sure the Jewish community, even those who supported Obama right now, are basically burning up the phone lines, calling and trying to lobby and trying to change things. Unfortunately, elections are over. Obama is no longer in need of their money, and the elected officials who are already sitting in their offices are no longer in need of their money. So the Jewish community is not going to have as much influence over the Democratic Party, and especially over Obama White House, as much as they did. Hillary is out. They cannot influence her. So it's open season for Obama, and we're just going to have to wait and see.
All of us, at least those on the more conservative side of the aisle, would love to see the United Nations just go away. We'd love to see President Trump turn that building in New York into some apartment buildings or something. But it's time. I mean, the United Nations, I think it had, when it was put to assembled back in right after World War II, probably had some good intentions. But those good intentions were never acted on, and they're not being acted on today. My goodness, what, we ignore what's going on in Syria with 500,000 deaths there, and yet we pick on the only democracy in the Middle East, Israel. Israel was very significant in your world, Brigitte. They came to your aid so many years ago when you were persecuted in Lebanon.
Yes, they did. Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, a true democracy. And, you know, maybe this vote at the United Nations, Jan, is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. I mean, we now at least have two elected officials in Congress calling for the stopping of the funding of the United Nations and getting it out of the United States. And we will see. Maybe that's exactly what we need. You know, people like you and me have been speaking about getting rid of the United Nations since 2004.
Yes.
You know, like you said, you know, we give them all this money, and here in Syria, hundreds of thousands of people are dying. We are witnessing ethnic cleansing from across
the
globe, and the only nation that they pick on is the nation of Israel, the only democratic country and the true ally of America and the Middle East. Actually, the Israelis are so kind that they are actually taking Syrian wounded and treating them in Israel for free just to take care of them. Just like what they did with me when I was a young girl in the war in Lebanon. Israel was our only lifeline. While our own government forgot about us during the civil war, the Lebanese civil war, Israel came in and helped the Christians and took them into Israel and gave them medical treatment and gave them everything they needed. And this is why you hear my passion for Israel, because I have witnessed it up close and personal, the compassion, the respect, and the values of the Israeli people, which is something unmatched in any other country anywhere in the Middle East.
Well, Brigitte, you're right. Your testimony is fascinating. What is the name of the book that has your testimony in it?
My book is titled Because They Hate, and it's a New York Times bestseller. It's about my testimony growing up in Lebanon as a Christian girl, going to Israel. Before I went to Israel, I was taught that Israel is bad and Israel is evil, and then ended up going to Israel and seeing how wonderful and amazing the Jews are and how they treated us, and they saved my mother's life. I ended up moving to Israel and working in Israel, so I encourage people to read that book. It's a truly inspiring story. And the book is titled Because They Hate.
That's the first book I became familiar of yours, Brigitte, with Brigitte's actual story in it, which is an amazing story. I mean, she ate grass, she barely survived, and she did escape, was aided by Israel, of course. That's a number of years ago. That was during the war in Lebanon in the mid-1970s. Incredible story, Because They Hate. Her other book is They Must Be Stopped. You can check that out at Amazon or find information at actforamerica.org.
Jan Markle, Olive Tree Ministries, interviewing Brigitte Gabriel, talking about this issue with the United Nations and how the greatest ally we have in the Middle East, the greatest democracy that we have in the Middle East that gives us hope, is the nation of Israel. And how we treat Israel is very significant to God. Israel is the apple, it says in the Bible, of God's eyes. I want to take the last 10 minutes or so on the broadcast today to emphasize teaching of Scripture in the Bible about God's attitude toward the oppressed. On this program this morning, we have talked about oppression. We have talked about the oppression of the Iranian women, of the Iranian people, because of the many rules and the code of conduct of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the heavy weight that they daily press on their own people through politics, through religion. There is no freedom in Iran. And anyone that tells you any differently, chalk it up as to someone that believes somehow, some way, that the government is really a good thing and they're kind of supporting the government in somehow, some way. Maybe they're getting some financial kickback, but there are millions of Iranians that every day feel this oppression. Thousands upon thousands have fled, like my friend Maral, from Iran, fearing their own life and safety, and have gone to countries and become citizens to escape Iran and the oppression that goes on there daily. And I have written books about this subject. One of them, The Rose of Nowruz, was the story of a young Iranian concert violinist who became a freedom fighter. I've written the stories of my Iranian friends in my book, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. A novel called Chasing After Rainbows, Stories of the Revolution, is the story of two young Iranian girls growing up during the revolution. This is based on a true story. And then, of course, recently, Rahane Jabari's story in my book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance, the story of how women can be raped in Iran and then subsequently executed if they don't change their story. This is a serious issue with me, and I want to go to the Bible because I am so encouraged by what the Bible says about God's attitude toward the oppressed people. The one scripture, and I'm going to talk about others, but the one scripture that is in almost every one of my books is a scripture I pray for my Iranian friends every day. It's from Psalm 72, verses 12 through 13. This psalm says, He will rescue the poor when they cry to Him. He will help the oppressed who have no one to defend them. He feels pity for the weak and needy, and He will rescue them because their lives are precious to Him. This is a wonderful promise that I pray almost daily for my Iranian friends, because it's a promise that God will intervene and rescue them. And I think of my dear friend Maral. He certainly did this for her. She was probably going to be detained and arrested. And because of God's great providence and great love for her, He found a way for her and her son Parham to leave that country. And yes, it was a very difficult journey to Germany, but He intervened in her situation. So I can attest to the fact that God does do what He says He's going to do. He will rescue poor when they cry to Him, and she did cry out to God. And so I want to talk to you this morning about the attitude of God's care for the oppressed. Psalm chapter 9, verses 7 through 10. But the Lord reigns forever, executing judgment from his throne. He will judge the world with justice and rule the nations with fairness. The Lord is a shelter for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. Those who know your name trust in you, for you, O Lord, do not abandon those who search for you. So we know that God is just. He will judge the world in fairness and justice and righteousness. And then the psalmist says, the Lord is a shelter for the oppressed, a refuge in the times of trouble. This is who God is. His character is one that you can trust, that he definitely cares. Psalm 103, verses 5 through 6, who satisfies my mouth with good things, so that my youth is renewed like the eagles. The Lord executes righteousness and judgment for all that are oppressed. Psalm 103, verses 5 through 6. Now listen to this psalm. The psalms are filled with this. Psalm 146, verses 5 through 7. But joyful are those who have the God of Israel as their helper, whose hope is in the Lord, their God. He made heaven and earth, the sea, and everything in them. He keeps every promise forever. He gives justice to the oppressed and food to the hungry. The Lord frees the prisoners. I love this. Then Psalm chapter 14, verse 6 says, the wicked frustrate the plans of the oppressed, but the Lord will protect his people. So these are definite promises of who God is, what he will do, his attitude toward the oppressed. He's a shelter. He executes righteousness and judgment for all that are oppressed. He gives justice to the oppressed and food to the hungry. He will protect them. He hears the cry of the oppressed. He will deliver them and rescue them. This is the God that I serve. This is the God that takes care of my Iranian friends daily. And as I mentioned to you, I'm in the process now of taking down my friend Maral's story, her amazing story of leaving with these refugees and heading from Iran into Germany, and just a grueling journey. And I'm in the process of meeting every day with her on Skype. I'll be meeting with her right after this program. And she is sharing with me detail after detail of the story. There are times when she shares that she just is in tears, remembering what happened to her and remembering the times that she was able to recharge her cell phone and to call me. And I'll remember a couple of times when Maral called me on her journey and was able to talk to me, and I was so encouraged to hear from her. She would cough violently. She had a very serious respiratory infection, and it is a miracle that her and her son made it all the way to Germany. As I said to you, this has become a new book for me, and probably in the middle of sometime in March, I will begin this book after everything has been put together. But I want to put a face on Maral and refugees. And by the way, not to forget, I'm also helping my other friend, Taymane. I call her affectionately my goddaughter. She is actually writing her story as an Iranian refugee, now living in Malaysia. So now all I'm doing in that situation is helping her edit and contributing in that way. But she's actually writing the book herself. So Maral and Taymane, two of my dearest Iranian friends in the world, I cannot wait for their books to be published, simply because, as I was starting to say, it's going to put a face on Iranian refugees and who they are. Because we hear sometimes of the really, really horrible stories. I remember one story in Australia where an Iranian refugee was struggling against the government there. They wouldn't do anything to help him and his wife, and it seems like he was put in this camp with hardly any adequate medical care, any food, and he just came to a meltdown emotionally, and he set himself on fire. A lot of Iranians do this just out of desperation. Women in Iran do this because of the male-dominated government. They have no hope, and they just set themselves on fire. Self-immolation. They do this to get the attention of the government, to get the attention of the world, but in the process, they're ending their own life, and it's very, very sad. And so this is the reason why I'm so excited about these two particular books, because as my friends and as those up on Amazon that purchase it will read it, it will put a face on refugees that have never been there before. I have looked a lot of places, and I don't see really a lot of books, maybe even one or two, but I don't see hardly any books on Iranian refugees. So that's going to change very, very soon, because their story needs to be out there. And it's an example of those Iranians who, by the grace of God, have managed to escape and are now living in other countries where there is, in some cases, limited freedom, in most cases, real freedom. And my dear friend Paymenet is in the process of getting that all-important interview, which will move her out of Malaysia, which is an Islamic country. That's not an easy place to live. It can be very dangerous. Move her out of that country into a more freer country where she is free. And I just am so thrilled that God has given me the platform, the means to put their story out there. And that's what this program is about. It's about other issues, and I talk from time to time about the Bible and other things. But most importantly, I keep my focus right on my Iranian friends because it's their program. It's really not my program as much as it is their program. And I always will do that as long as God gives me the opportunity. That's why it's called The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. Well, I want to just close today reflecting on this program and reflecting on the cry of the oppressed by asking you as a listener to please join me daily in speaking out and praying for them. Many of you probably think, well, does this really make a difference? And I will say to you, yes, it does. Case in point, we have spoken out, we have prayed, we have petitioned, and Arash Sadaji, who was on the hunger strike and struggling to get real medical attention, is now starting to get that medical attention. And I believe it's because the community of you and me and thousands of others are speaking out and petitioning and putting pressure on the Iranian government. That's what we have to do. So do you say, does it make a difference? Yes, it does make a difference. We struggled in prayer and petitioning, and Saeed Abedini, just a year ago, and three other Americans were released from Iran by the grace of God. Now, we worked with the American Center for Law and Justice. They were the biggest impetus in his release, but we all joined together and we spoke out and prayed and petitioned. So it does, in the end, make a difference. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me today and listening to the cries of my Iranian friends. It is always a pleasure to come to you this way and to share their stories. I hope and pray that you have a fantastic weekend, and join me again on Monday for another edition of The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. This is Randy Noble saying, have a marvelous weekend. God bless you. I will see you on Monday.
Faithful lightning of his head.